In the first part of the program today, we'll be talking with novelist Amitav Ghosh. He is probably one of the best-known Indian writers writing in English today. He's the author of a number of books, including The Circle of Reason, The Shadow Lines, In an Antique Land, Dancing in Cambodia, and The Calcutta Chromosome. His most recent novel is a multi-generational family story spanning a period of over 100 years that is also, in many, many respects, a book about colonialism and nationalism as those forces played out in India and Burma and Malaysia. The title of the book is The Glass Palace. It's published by Random House and has been out now not very long. I think it came out officially the beginning of February and has gotten a lot of positive attention. And we're pleased that he could spend a little time with us this morning talking about his writing. Just a bit more about Amitav Ghosh. He was born in Calcutta. He has worked as a newspaperman. He was a journalist working for the Indian Express newspaper of New Delhi and earned a doctorate in Oxford, all of that before he wrote his first novel. He's won a number of awards for his work, including the 1999 Pushcart Prize for an essay that was published in the Kenyan Review. In 1999, he was a finalist for the National Magazine Awards for a story that he wrote that was published in 1998 in the New Yorker magazine. In 1999, he joined the faculty at Queens College in the City University of New York as distinguished professor in the Department of Comparative Literature, teaching writing and courses on film and literature. He's also taught at Columbia, at the Delhi School of Economics, and also University of Virginia. As we talk, questions, comments certainly are welcome. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guests, you certainly may do that. All we ask of people is that they just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But anyone certainly is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-WILL, or 9455. So that's for local folks. But if it would be a long-distance call for you, use our toll-free number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here locally, 333-9455. And any place else, 800-222-9455. Amitav Ghosh, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
The book begins with Britain completing its takeover of Burma, something that was done in two stages for some years before 1885. Britain controlled the lower portion and then moved in and took over the rest. To the extent that one can say, what was Burma like, the upper Burma? What was it like before it was annexed by Britain?
Well, it was a relatively prosperous country, you know. I mean, because it was a sort of Buddhist country where the Buddhist priesthood was very involved in education and so on, it had a very high rate of literacy. It was a very rich country because it had a lot of natural resources, lots of timber, gemstones, and so on. But it was also, you know, in a strange way, quite a forward-looking place. I mean, the then king of Burma was, busy, doing all sorts of modernization projects. I mean, he'd started a telegraph service, and he was, looking into building railway lines and so on. So, in a sense, I suppose the closest sort of comparison would be with 19th century Thailand.
Mm. And the British, when they moved in, they deposed the royal family. They moved them to India. They wanted them out of the way so that there would not be a possibility, or at least it would be more difficult for Burmese to have them as a rallying point for an uprising against the British.
That's exactly right, because by that point, you see, the British had a lot of trouble in India, you know. I mean, there had always been a fair amount of resistance, towards colonialism from Indians. And when they got to Burma, they were just determined that, to apply the lessons, as they called it, that they'd learned in India. And they just wanted to make sure that there was no kind of focus for any kind of anti-colonial uprising. So they just wanted the king to be forgotten. And the strange thing was that they took this so seriously that they wouldn't actually even allow the king to be photographed in exile. And I just recently discovered that even after Burma became an independent country, in 1948 or something, the then elected Burmese government wanted to have the king's remains sent back from India. But the British ambassador, or high commissioner as he was called, in Burma, actually objected and said that this would create anti-colonial feelings. And of course, this was after Burma was an independent country.
Mm. So after the royals went to Ratnagiri, lived there in diminished circumstances, the king died there in 1916, and his remains are still there?
Yes, absolutely. They're still there. There's a kind of monument to him there. Yes, absolutely.
Mm. So for the British, this was not only did they see this as, because they were in India, part of their, one might say, their natural sphere of influence, but also their interest was the resources that were there to be had.
Yes. Burma was an extraordinarily rich country. I mean, you know, at the turn of the century, the port of Rangoon was exporting more than all the major ports of India put together. There was an incredible sort of natural wealth in Burma, and apart from the teak and the gemstones, there was oil. You'll remember that the Shell Oil Company,
mm-hmm.
Used once upon a time to be called Burma Shell, and that's where it had its beginnings.
The main protagonist, I guess, in the book.
Yeah.
Rajkumar,
yeah.
When we encounter him first, is an Indian boy, an orphan, who ends up in Burma rather by accident.
Yeah.
And then goes on, as he is has the entrepreneurial spirit, goes on to make his fortune in teak and then in rubber. And one of the things that he does is early on, as he's trying to raise money to buy his initial lumberyard to get started, is he gets involved in persuading, and that might be too gentle a word, Indians, workers, to go and become indentured servants in Burma. And
Yes. We
see them, the man first that he is with, that he learns this from, going in around in India to the countryside and promising, saying, this is the place where you can make your fortune. There's great wealth to be made. All you have to do is go over there, work for a few years, and then you can come back to India and be a rich man, and it'd be good for you and good for your family. Is that the way, in fact, that Indians or some Indians thought about Burma?
Yes, certainly. I remember my one of my uncles telling me that, you know, in the early part of this century, just as in America people used to say, go west, young man, to many people in India, that's they would say, go to Burma. Now, as you can imagine, this may have offered opportunities to Indians, but the Burmese didn't necessarily look very kindly on this, because it meant that, you know, their resources were being exploited by two groups of people rather than just one. But, you know, to take up the question of, you know, what Rajkumar was doing, transporting these workers and laborers to Burma, that's actually a really sad and painful episode in Indian history, you know, where just large groups of people were really displaced, you know, under false pretenses, really. And when we say indentured labor, really, it's just, you know, another way of talking about slavery, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in effect, what was happening there. I mean, India in the late 19th century was really a sort of great pool of labor, which the British deployed here and there in their colonies to do, as it were, the dirty work of empire. But often the people who were facilitating this were Indians as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that's a very important idea that you explore in the book, how it is that Indians were involved doing the work of the British. They were, in fact, when we talk about this invasion of Burma, most of the troops that were involved that the British used were Indians. They were also used later to put down a rebellion in Burma in the 30s. Of course, the Indians did indeed fight against the Japanese, and one might argue that that might have been in their interest. But I know that's something you have given a great deal of thought to, and especially because your father served in the British Indian Army.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Certainly, you know, one of the sort of issues that arises for me, for example, when I look back on this past, and certainly it's an issue that's at the heart of this book, is the question of what was the nature of Indian complicity with colonialism, you know? And there really was a very sort of intense complicity there, you know. I mean, often Indians just thought that they could profit from certain aspects of the empire as well. And, you know, it's certainly the case that Indians were used constantly in putting down any kind of resistance to the British Empire. And I think as an Indian, when you look back on this, it's a really sobering a thing, you know. It's very hard to look back on this with any kind of pleasure, certainly. But, you know, when we come to the Second World War, you have, on the one hand, tens of thousands of Indians fighting for the British Army. And, you know, I think in general in India, everybody was completely opposed, to fascism and Japanese militarism. But what the leaders of India always said, and what they said repeatedly in the period of about 1939 to 1940, is that if this is a war for freedom, then surely we can only participate in this war as a free peoples. And at that point, Churchill just absolutely repudiated them and said, nothing doing. The talks about independence are suspended, and you're going to fight in this war whether you like it or not. When I look back on that particular sort of episode in Indian history, when, in fact, you did have this, people within the Indian Army really trying to decide, you know, what is the proper course of action for us? What do we do? Do we fight in a war where we're being made to fight, even though our political leadership says that, you know, we are not an autonomous or independent people here? Or, you know, do we just do our job, or what do we do? And there's something very poignant in that circumstance for me. I don't think that I can... I don't know really how one passes judgment on that particular moment in history, but certainly I do recognize the incredible sort of poignance of it. And that's really one of the things that I wanted to explore in this book, that is the real sort of conflict that these soldiers faced. Mm.
And it is something that that some of your characters do indeed struggle with and voice these very concerns.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Especially one of my characters, Arjun, he's, a young officer in the British Indian Army. He's, you know, just a happy-go-lucky kind of army guy, you know, enjoying himself, doing the things that young officers do. And then he finds himself in Malaya, suddenly facing the Japanese army. And at this point, when he's suddenly facing also the incredible racism of the British Army and of British colonialism, he suddenly begins to ask himself, you know, who am I? What do I do? And for me, the real poignance of his situation is that I don't know whether there was any good decision that he could have made, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a way that's also a metaphor for colonial peoples in some way. That is, it's very, very hard for people who lived through the colonial experience to actually try and find their own voice, you know, to try and find their own ways of articulating their own identity, if you like.
I was interested in it, and I guess I was also reminded of this by one of the reviews of the book, and your choice of the name of this particular character. It does harken back to the Mahabharata, which I know I read a long, long time ago, where there is a character, a warrior named Arjun, who steps out of the battle for a while and has this extended meditation on what it is he's doing and why he's doing it. So I'm sure that was the deliberate borrowing of that name.
It's very interesting that you point to that, because actually very few reviews have picked up on it, even within India. Yes, you know, the central section of the Mahabharata, which is a section known as the Bhagavad Gita, deals with Arjun's conflict upon the field of battle. And Arjun at this point is advised by the god Krishna, who comes down to, who's his charioteer, and who speaks to him about what the nature of duty is and what the nature of loyalty is and what it means to be a warrior. I think, you know, when I was writing this section, or when I was even thinking about it, I suddenly realized that, the power of that situation, the power of that central sort of image in the Mahabharata, of the conflicted warrior, it was so deeply embedded in my head that in some sense it was expressing itself in this. It was in some way, at the foundations of my cultural self. And once I recognized that, I made it quite explicit, because Arjun is named after Arjun, and his Batman here, his amanuensis, is called Kishan Singh. And Kishan Singh is from Kurukshetra, where the Battle of the Mahabharata was fought. I didn't want to stretch that parallel too far. Mm. But I think for any Indian, that situation has so much mythic resonance that it's that it communicates much more than just the situation itself.
Perhaps here I should just very quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with Amitav Ghosh. He's a novelist. He's written a number of books, and his most recent one that has just come out is The Glass Palace, which is, as I mentioned at the beginning, a multi-generational family story. In part, it is a love story that spans more than a century, but it also is very much an exploration of colonialism, nationalism, and how these forces played out in Burma, in Malaysia, and in India, beginning, as the novel does, with the completion of the Indian annexation of Burma. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. We do have a caller here to start with in Urbana on our line number one, so let's do that. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was curious about what the author said about Shell Oil Company drilling for oil in Burma, and I just wondered if they're still doing that or if they used up all the oil.
That's a very interesting question, and you might be interested to know that in Burma, actually, people didn't even have to drill for oil. There was a place called Yenangyaung in central Burma where oil actually naturally seeped to the surface of the soil. And, this oil was believed to have sort of medicinal properties in Chinese medicine. For millennia, traders had been coming there to collect this oil and take it away. And there was this whole sort of subculture around it, this sort of outcast society of people who would just make these sort of wells in the ground and pull the oil out with buckets. It's something I've described at some length, in my book, because I was so fascinated by this image of, these people who were just pulling out oil in buckets. And at times, the oil would catch fire. And we have many, many sort of historical reports of this, of, the whole hillsides being just carpeted in shimmering sheets of flame.
Yeah.
And, it was something very interesting to me. But around about 1890, when oil became a sort of major commodity, that was when the British really began to drill for oil there and to create sort of a modern oil industry. And, two or three major companies moved in there, and they exploited the oil very, very efficiently. And in fact, those fields are really largely depleted now. And even Shell Oil, which used to be called Burma Shell, has dropped the Burma from their name. But there's a further sort of angle to this story, which is that very recently, other deposits of oil and natural gas have been found in and around Burma. And certain companies today are actually working with the Burmese government, or the government of Myanmar, as it's now called, to exploit this oil. Now, Aung San Suu Kyi, who many of you will have heard of, who is the Nobel Prize-winning leader of the Burmese democracy movement, she's objected very vigorously to this because she says it's providing support for an essentially illegal government. And this has been a sort of central point amongst Burma activists in the U.S. and in Burma and around the world.
Well, is Burma independent country now, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, and has been since 1947, yes.
Uh-huh.
But Burma is, what happened in Burma is that From about 1962 onwards, the Burmese government was deposed by a military junta. And this military junta, sort of suppressed democracy and so on. And it's really one of the most sort of sinister regimes you'll see anywhere in the world. Now, in 1988, a very large democracy movement started up in Burma, and it was led by this woman, Aung San Suu Kyi, who's revered in Burma today and who's under house arrest in Rangoon as we speak. She won nationwide elections that were held in 1990. But instead of allowing her party to come to power, the junta continued in power and locked her up, and she's been under house arrest ever since. She is in some sense the legitimate leader of Burma, she feels that oil companies, etc., should not support the current regime.
So they are still drilling for oil in Burma?
Yes, and they're building pipelines and so on, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I was just curious, in light of the fact that the U.S. wants to drill for oil along the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and so I just wondered if this was any source of supply. Does any of that oil get to the United States?
I'm not actually certain about that. I think the companies that are building pipelines and so on in Burma are not actually affiliated to any U.S. companies. Mm. Supporters of Burmese democracy in the U.S. are very well organized, and they've certainly made it clear to all these companies that that they shouldn't be investing in these ways inside that country right now.
Well, are you from Burma?
No, I'm not. I'm from India, actually. But a part of my family had settled in Burma, and my favorite uncle, when I was a child, he'd grown up in Burma, and in fact, this book began for me as a kind of family memoir, as an exploration of my family's links with Burma. So, in some sense, that's what the book is about, the relationship of Indian families with Burma.
Well, thank you. This is very interesting.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Other folks are certainly welcome to call 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Aung San Suu Kyi makes a brief appearance at the end of the book.
Yes.
And I know, actually, that you've had an opportunity to, as a journalist, to meet with her.
Yes, I've met with her twice, actually.
What sort of possibility do you think there is for a change, a political change, in Burma?
Well, that's a very sort of complicated question, and, there are sort of many dimensions to it. Let me say, to begin with, that Aung San Suu Kyi is, for me, really one of the sort of exemplary figures of our era. She's a woman of just incredible sort of magnetism and serenity. And my meeting with her really was, one of the most memorable experiences of my life. I mean, both my meetings, I would say. And, I think of her as really one of the great heroes of our age. That being said, it doesn't seem at the moment that there's much change underway in Burma. In many ways, the Burmese regime has actually grown stronger. But right now, there is a sort of thaw, and the regime is actually holding talks with Aung San Suu Kyi. And it's perfectly possible that we will see some slight leeway and, modification in the present situation in the near future.
I don't want to exactly belabor this point, but this is, in a way, I think, going back to some of our earlier discussion. And I ask the question both because in one of the interviews that I've read where you've talked about the experience of writing the book, you talked about it being for you a transformative experience.
Yeah.
And also, I was struck by one reviewer in particular, an Indian literary critic, who said that The Glass Palace was the most scathing critique of British colonialism she had ever come across in fiction. You said this started out as a family memoir, but at some point did it become your intention to make a critique of British colonialism?
No, not at all, really. I mean, my book is about people. You know, it's about people and their predicaments and the circumstances and predicaments that are created by history, as it were. And really, for me, this book is a book about the world that my characters experienced. But, you know, I think what has happened, really, is that when people write about this aspect of our, of the past of India or the past of Asia, there really is an awful lot of sort of romanticism about the British Empire, you know, and especially amongst Europeans and especially amongst Westerners. A lot of writing about the Indian past is cast within this sort of rosy glow of, Bara Sahibs going to their clubs and playing polo and so on. And, the reality was nothing like that. This was an extremely brutal empire, and it was brutal in its fundamental projects. For me, this did not begin. This apperception didn't really start as a, as an ideological thing at all. It came about as a kind of discovery, because in writing this book, I really interviewed hundreds, of people across India and across Asia. And really, it was a slow process of discovery of what they had lived through. And at the end of it, really, a process of writing about the past became for me a process of discovery about the past. And at the end of it, I was truly appalled that, that it was possible to write about the Indian past within that sort of glowing vision of empire. Hmm. Maybe I could just quote to you just a little paragraph, really, that was sent to me recently by actually a professor at the University of Urbana-Champaign.
Yes.
This quote is from Jawaharlal Nehru, who was India's first prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called The Discovery of India, which is very highly regarded and very important book. He wrote, I'm quoting now, "Biologists tell us that racialism is a myth and there is no such thing as a master race. But we in India have known racialism in all its forms, ever since the commencement of British rule. The whole ideology of this rule was that of the Herrenvolk and the master race, and the structure of government was based upon it. Indeed, the idea of a master race is inherent in imperialism. There was no subterfuge about it. It was proclaimed in unambiguous language by those in authority." Unquote. So you see, in some sense, for me, I really came to take very seriously the idea that Mahatma Gandhi, always put forth, which is that imperialism was really the progenitor of fascism. Hmm. And, once you do see it in that light, you do begin to realize that, to write about colonialism is a thing that is laden with moral imperatives that you really cannot escape from.
One other thing here that I guess has happened fairly recently concerning the book that I wanted to ask you about. You talked a little bit earlier about sometimes the difficulty of peoples who have been colonies of finding their own voices.
Yeah.
Your book, a little earlier this month, was nominated, actually was named a regional winner for the 2001 Commonwealth Writers Prize, and would have been a finalist in this contest that would be chosen next month. And just, I think, a few days ago, you wrote to the people who ran the contest and requested that your novel be withdrawn, and in fact said if you had known the publishers were going to nominate it, you would have asked them not to. And your reason for doing this was questioning the whole concept. Perhaps this is something that you could talk about.
Yes, certainly. I'd be happy to. In fact, this last week I've been doing little else but talk about this, as you can imagine, because it's sort of become a kind of minor storm, and I've been bombarded with emails and interviews and so on. I don't know what the Commonwealth means to you. You probably think of it in terms of the Commonwealth of Virginia or something like that. But the Commonwealth in Asia has a very particular meaning, in Asia and Africa. It's a word with a certain kinds of connotations around it. And really what it is that, it's a certain vision of empire. It's a vision of the British Empire. Now, one of the things that really became a major problem for me when I was writing The Glass Palace is that I began to see the ways in which the English language itself frames the colonial past, you know. For example, just to give you one very brief example, when the British invaded Burma in 1885, this was followed by a really brutal campaign of suppression, you know, that ranged through northern Burma, you know, to put down really all traces of resistance to British rule. Now, in the British sources, in British history, this campaign is not called a campaign of repression, nor is it called an invasion. What it's called is named as a pacification campaign, you know. And in fact, if you look at the whole sort of rhetoric of British rule in Asia, it's always framed in these terms, you know, invasions become pacification campaigns, you know, and so on and so forth. And really, for me, when I was writing The Glass Palace, I suddenly realized that in a way I had to break the compact with this language, you know, that I had to seize the right to name this past in terms that I saw a fit. And really, you know, one of the things that became very important for me here was that to refuse to deal in euphemisms, you know. And the Commonwealth as a term for the British Empire really, to me, is an absolute euphemism. There was no wealth created, at least for the Asian and African parts of this empire. These colonies were squeezed dry, you know. When the British came to India in the late 18th century, India controlled 25% of world trade. By the time they left, it controlled 1/100th of that, you know. And, to call it a commonwealth, to my mind, is an absolute misnomer. And, I felt that, you know, if I do believe this, then I have to really break my compact with this language, at least with this way of naming the past. And, you know, it was a real conflict for me when this prize came up. Of all the prizes that my book might have got and which I would gladly have accepted, this was the only one that I can think of that I would not have, you know. Anyway, it came my way, and my initial response, my absolute instinctive response, was to say no straight away. But then I thought to myself, look, there's no point in just acting emotionally on this. There's a lot of money involved, and this money could come my way. And, of course, everybody can use money. But I thought, you know, I have to think this through. I have to think through the whole question of, you know, why do I find these terms objectionable? Why do I find that I don't want this prize? So I sat down and wrote this letter. And, you know, it took me a long time, and I really worked at it, and I decided that, you know, I wasn't going to respond in a thoughtless way. And actually, I think it served a very good purpose, because, you know, ever since I sent that letter out at the beginning of this week, I've just been deluged with email. And, in fact, I gather now that the Commonwealth Foundation is rethinking its whole strategy vis-a-vis these prizes.
The Glass Palace was, in fact, not a building, but it was a room in the palace of the King of Burma in Mandalay.
Yes.
What, for you, I wonder, what's the significance of the Glass Palace and why you chose to title the book The Glass Palace?
That's a very interesting question. You see, the Glass Palace was actually a sort of chamber, as you said, within the sort of royal palace complex of Mandalay. But it was also, you know, it was almost the symbolic heart of the, of the ruling structure in Burma. And the dynasty that was then ruling Mandalay was called the Konbaung dynasty. And their dynastic history is actually called the Glass Palace Chronicles. And, you know, it's such a beautiful name to begin with, and it's a very interesting book as well, you know, one of the founding texts of Burmese literature. And, you know, when I was writing this book, it seemed to me that in many ways I was continuing this history, because I was writing about the forgotten past of this dynasty, which is the past of these kings of the last king of Burma in exile, you know. And to my mind, it was a very poignant and touching story, you know, what happened to the king and queen of Burma when they were sent to exile in India. And in this way, the Glass Palace, you know, seemed absolutely the perfect name for the book.
We're approaching the point where we have about 12 or 14 minutes left, and perhaps again I'll introduce our guest. We're speaking with Amitav Ghosh. He's a writer, probably one of India's best-known writers who write in English. He's the author of a number of novels. His most recent, just out a few weeks, the book that we're talking about here this morning is The Glass Palace, and it's published by Random House. It is out now and available in the bookstore if you'd like to look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. There is, obviously you did a great deal of research and travel to gather the kind of detail that go into the book, and I'm very impressed with it in so many places. Just for one example, in the beginning section where we meet Rajkumar and we get some tour of the teak business,
yes,
at the time, was this something that you actually went and observed firsthand? And do they still do it? I would imagine now they're using big gasoline-powered equipment and perhaps not using elephants so much anymore, but maybe they still do.
Well, there are places both in Burma and in Thailand where elephants still are used in logging. They still are used in logging even in India, actually, quite widely. But, you know, for me, the teak industry was a very important, it was a very interesting kind of industry, really, because, of course, my uncle, who'd lived in Burma, he'd made a fortune in teak. And when I was a child, he would talk about logging all the time. He would sort of describe, you know, what the whole sort of way of life that was around teak and, you know, what it was like and so on. And, you know, for me, that business of, you know, chopping down forests, if you like, you know, in order to get at the timber, it in some way expresses the sort of you know, if you like, the sort of ambiguities of this whole project, because on the one hand, you know, Rajkumar is making his fortune. At the same time, he's destroying, really, he's destroying exactly what he most loves, which is the forest. So, you know, in many ways, it became a very poignant thing, you know, to write about, and also a very interesting thing, because logging was a way of life, and it was a very particular way of life, and to me, a very interesting way of life. And I've always been fascinated by the ways in which people make their livings.
We have a caller here, someone on a car phone, so let's get to them. We don't want to make them wait, and it's line number one. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by your guest. I've been a student of the history of the subcontinent of India for some time. And it sounds a bit anti-British at this point, and obviously imperialism, colonialism is out of fashion. The comment that I would like to make, however, is that of all of the former British colonies, or as you will, India is the one that was best prepared for democracy, and the unification that occurred under the British Raj probably help that. And I'd like to have your guest comment on that. I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the comment. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, my first response to that would be to say that, in fact, you know, if anything prepared India for democracy, it was not the British, but rather the struggle against the British. Because, in effect, that was what really created the foundations of the Indian state as we know it today. Because, you know, the whole Indian freedom movement, you know, became a sort of a process of discovering a sort of a political a form that would be appropriate to India. So I think it would, you know, to think, to attribute Indian democracy to the British is to put the cart before the horse, as it were, because it was really the anti-colonial struggle that created this, the institutions that we have today. Secondly, I would say that, you know, Indian democracy is a very, very interesting and vital institution. And what is most interesting and vital about it is that it's not, in some sense, the same thing as democracy everywhere else, which is to say that within, say, many places in other parts of the world, democracy is really just one way of administering a country, you know. It's one way of administering a political unit. In India, democracy is just as much about self-expression, you know. It's about the whole, it's about the whole idea of, you know, how do you find your place in the world. And that is something that really comes, you know, It's a specifically sort of Indian contribution to the idea of democracy as we see it practiced today. And that, again, I would say really comes from, you know, the roots of Indian culture. Thirdly, I would say that, you know, in effect, the unification of the Indian subcontinent under the British actually led to the dismemberment of the Indian subcontinent. Just before the departure of the British, that is, it was the creation of Pakistan and of India and, you know, the area that we now know as Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and so on. And I would say that, in fact, you know, the peculiar legacy of the Raj was to divide the Indian subcontinent. Far from unifying it, it was to divide it in such a way that it was actually to institutionalize a conflict, really. So on all those counts, I would say that really I can't see that really there were any benefits to that particular aspect of the colonial past.
We have talked a lot about the issues that underlie the book, and I would like to second something that you said earlier in the interview when you said, really, it's a story about people.
Yeah.
And indeed it is, and I don't want people who are listening to us to perhaps come away with the wrong idea about the book, because it is a great story, and it is a story about people. And we're coming here to the point where we have maybe about 6 or 7 minutes left, and this is not something that we asked you about before we got going, but since we have such a nice connection, I was wondering if you might want to read a little bit, if you have a copy at hand.
Sure, I have a copy right here. And would you maybe I'll read from the beginning.
Yes.
From the very start of the book. Well, this is the moment when Rajkumar finds himself in Mandalay in 1885, and this is the very start of the book. So I'll just begin there. There was only one person in the food stall who knew exactly what that sound was that was rolling in across the plain along the silver curve of the Irrawaddy to the western wall of Mandalay's fort. His name was Rajkumar, and he was an Indian, a boy of 11, not an authority to be relied upon. The noise was unfamiliar and unsettling, a distant booming followed by low, stuttering growls. At times it was like the snapping of dry twigs, sudden and unexpected, and then abruptly it would change to a deep rumble, shaking the food stall and rattling its steaming pot of soup. The stall had only two benches, and they were both packed with people, sitting pressed up against each other. It was cold, the start of central Burma's brief but chilly winter, and the sun had not risen high enough yet to burn off the damp mist that had drifted in at dawn from the river. When the first booms reached the stall, there was a silence, followed by a flurry of questions and whispered answers. People looked around in bewilderment. What is it? Bale, what can it be? And then Rajkumar's sharp, excited voice cut through the buzz of speculation. English cannon, he said, in his fluent but heavily accented Burmese. They're shooting somewhere up the river, heading in this direction. Shall I stop there?
I sort of hate to make you stop, but yes, perhaps that would be a good place to stop. And of course, here indeed, this is the beginning of the book, and it is the sound of the cannon as the British advance. And very, very quickly, they defeat the Army of Burma. The British troops, many of them Indian troops, march in. They sack the palace, take what they could, and leave. And then the people, the doors of the palace are standing open, and the people who have always lived around it decide, well, maybe we better have a look inside. And then that is where our hero, Raj Kumaris, first sets eyes on then a little girl, a woman that he would meet years later, but it was a matter of love at first sight.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I don't know if you would necessarily call it love right at that moment. It certainly became, a kind of obsessional search for him, which ended in love, yes.
And what's fascinating about this particular point is when the people come into the palace, they see all this great wealth, and apparently, and one could hardly blame them, decide maybe they should help themselves too and start prying precious stones off the walls. And then when the queen appears, here the people are, they're looting the palace, and yet they cannot help themselves. What do? They bow.
Yes. Absolutely. That's exactly, that's how it happens in the book. But it's also how it happened in the, in history. I actually followed the historical sources quite closely on this. And you see, what happened is that when the British soldiers marched into the palace, they looted it too. Mm-hmm. They carried away whole sackfuls of loot. And I guess when the townspeople saw this, they thought, why should we leave it all for the foreigners? Let's help ourselves to something ourselves. Then they walk in and, there they find the king and queen of Burma. And it's a curious thing that, the then queen of Burma, Queen Supayalat, was a woman who was very widely disliked. I mean, she was a very kind of tough and fierce woman. But yet, when the king and queen were taken away from the palace, we have many, many reports of how everybody cried. The streets filled with people who followed their carriages, and people wept and wept and wept. And, they really experienced themselves as being, in some sense, deprived, as something very precious being taken away. Mm. And to this day, that particular memory is very vivid in Burma, of that moment when the king and queen were forcibly removed.
Even though it's been more than 100 years.
Yes. I mean, I think it was, in many ways, a national trauma. It's something which people still remember. I mean, of course, there are many different ways of remembering it, but it was a moment which lives in people's minds. The Burmese are people who have a very, very intense awareness of their history. I mean, one of their kings, who I actually talked about in this book, was famous because he ran away from the Chinese, and they, to this day, when they speak of him, he has an epithet, the one who ran away from the Chinese. And this was something that happened 500 years ago.
Well, we've come to the end of the time, and I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop, but it's been a great pleasure to talk with you, and I appreciate it. It's a great story that you've written, and I thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much, David. It was a great pleasure.
Our guest, Amitav Ghosh, and his book, again, is titled The Glass Palace. It's published by Random House, just out, should be available in a bookstore near you.